Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hooray for Communist China show, our all-American salute to Communist China, where they ban smoking in indoor events, despite the fact that we cannot do that here in Kentucky. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and here from the University of Kentucky to serve as a smokescreen for Health Matters.
Really?
To smoke out poor stories.
Wait, why are you going smokeless on me? Or smoke why are you using all this smoke?
Because by jingo, smoke.
And you're literally just blowing smoke right now.
From the University of Kentucky, Manager of Communications Infrastructure, a man that I cannot describe in smoky terms, Rick Phillips, to talk to you about our internet presence. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's more at State Public Radio's website. Peruse it for a little bit. Enjoy it. There's lots of good shows on there, but find your way over to Health Matters. There you will find all the shows. Well, I always say all the shows. All the recent shows. We literally have been on the air so long that we would literally make the servers explode if they put all of our audio on there. Right, Tony?
You bet.
I mean, you know, what is it?
We'll make them explode.
Is it 11 years? 12 years? Do you even know?
No, I really don't.
You don't keep track of our anniversary?
February 2003.
Good answer.
A bitterly cold, icy night.
Yeah, there you go. So anyway, audio of the show is WMKY.org. You can download them. You can join the podcast, have it delivered right to you automatically. If you're done with all that and you want to interact with the show, jump over to Facebook. We do have a fan page on Facebook. That would be facebook.com/HM Radio Show. Or you can just do a search for Health Matters Radio Show. You'll find us there. You will interact with the show. Leave us some show topics. Leave us some feedback, comments. You know, there's all kinds of neat little things there and ways to interact with myself and Tony. It's surprisingly, we both monitor it. Well, I don't respond as much as Tony does, but you know what? You will be interacted with, I suspect. I don't know, Tony, can you think of any reason why they wouldn't be interacted with?
Well, when Bill asked me to do something about soy, that I'm not a big soy fan, so that's going to be a tough one.
Can we talk about how I eat a lot of soy sauce? Is that close enough?
Yeah, what's the relationship between soy and soy sauce? Yeah, we'll get to it, Bill.
Bill's a long time listener.
Suffer, yeah.
You say potato.
I say mater.
So, anyway, Facebook.com, you can interact with us. And as Bill has so painfully found out, that we do, in fact, talk back. That's what you can find, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, the patient.
We have a sponsor?
Yes. We always have a sponsor.
Oh.
Patient selection for lung cancer screening. Just reminding you, lung cancer screening is a new idea and will be coming to a healthcare facility near you very soon. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommends smoke or ex-smokers ages 55 to 80, those who have smoked for 30 pack years, that means a pack a day for 30 years or more, and have quit less than 15 years ago, those are the people that they are targeting for lung cancer screening. American Cancer Society says 55 to 74 rather than 55 to 80, but then the same parameters, 30 pack years, quit less than 15. According to the American Cancer Society, you need to discuss this with your doctor and engage in what they call shared decision making. No one's going to rush in the room and tell you to get screened for lung cancer. You've got to recognize the risks, the benefits of it, and make a decision. Also, according to the American Cancer Society and virtually all groups, including Medicare, that support lung cancer screening, you need to think about stopping smoking. You need to make a decision and get counseling for smoking cessation if you're going to get screened. Medicare says ages 55 to 77, 30 pack years, less than 15 years quit, and again, document shared decision making where you and your doctor discuss the risk and benefits of lung cancer screening and make sure that you have at least considered and hopefully undertaken tobacco smoking cessation interventions. We'll talk some about the risk of screening for lung cancer, the benefits for screening for lung cancer, who is at the highest risk in our second fractional portion. Our sponsor, patient selection for lung cancer screening. Again, lung cancer screening is coming. We want to make sure if you are a good candidate that you consider this, talk with your doctor about this, and make a shared decision. Now, the name of the show, Hooray for Communist China. First of all, not that that would cause any anxiety among our listeners.
Okay.
Who are very open-minded
people.
You
were that excited about their ban on smoking?
Yes. Again, Beijing, 4 million smokers in the city, one-fifth of the population. Overall, they make up, again, one-fifth. They are banned from smoking in any enclosed public space, including offices, shops, bars, restaurants, nightclubs, airports, and trains. If you go to the Forbidden City or Great Wall and you smoke there, $32 fine, $32 equivalent. If you are a business owner who permits smoking on your premises, $1,600 fine. Now, thing you've got to realize about this, and I'm reading this, I have not been to China, but this is according, again, to New York Times, a Reuters news report. Cigarettes are a national pastime, 50% smoking rate among men. Wedding banquet tables routinely feature packs of stacked cigarettes as a party favor. Cartons have been given as presents. There is a state-run monopoly that manufactures one-third of the world's cigarettes, and obviously is those are heavily smoked in China. So the government has a direct financial interest in promoting smoking, and yet they have issued this decree. 300 million smokers, a third of the world's total live in China, 53% of men, and only about 3% of women smoke regularly in China, and yet they are now banning smoking. And congratulations to them. There are some serious issues about whether or not it'll be enforced. They have tried in 1996 to ban cigarette smoking indoors in Beijing, and in 2008 Olympic Games they were banned, but it was widely ignored each time. They have a new enforcement mechanism. I am just pleading with the politicians in the state of Kentucky, our dictators, our political leaders, can we get to the point where we are in a similar position to communist China? We are considering how to enforce a smoking ban, whether or not, rather than considering whether or not to have one.
I like it.
Okay.
I'm curious with, because, you know, here in Kentucky, we always hear about, you know, people raising tobacco, right? Number one industry, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, you hear they're still selling it overseas, right? So they're not selling a lot of it in the U.S. They're selling more overseas. I would think that this is going to curtail the sale of it in, obviously, in China.
Well, the cynics just say this is not going to make any difference. It's just another, it's kind of a publicity thing, a public relations thing. And they have shown repeatedly they cannot enforce a ban. I don't know.
They've put on paper their expression that cigarettes are dangerous, right? Doesn't this verbally, I mean, doesn't this decrees China feels cigarettes have issues?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean, which, let's be honest, even though it sounds really simple, didn't exist before. Where was the U.S. 40 years ago? We were in the same boat. We didn't think there was a problem. Now, the problem is for China is they're going to have an accelerated path that we walk. So we went, it took us so many, you know, 20, 30 years to start figuring out that more than just a label on the pack is what you need to start solving healthcare crisis. I think where it may have taken us 40 years to get from, well, and in some cases, look at them, they're already ahead of us. I can't imagine that this decree won't start that clock ticking on eventually I mean, I guess what I'm saying is the people that grow tobacco in America should be concerned.
Right.
Should be very, very concerned.
And the, again, the male Chinese, 53% smoking rates, Kentucky, 27%, the rest of the United States in aggregate around 19% or so. You kind of get a picture of where smoking should be headed. But right now, tobacco companies are marketing to developing countries. There's plenty of open markets. And in fact, in some cases, embarrassingly, U.S. trade laws are being used to sledgehammer small governments into allowing U.S. tobacco companies in. It's an embarrassment to our country. In my mind, we are a worldwide peddler of death in that way. Another thing you don't think so much about, Rick, is that, again, a populous country like China, making these type of shifts will prolong their life expectancy, will cause some demographic shifts. Again, this is the number one preventable cause of death. If you were to take action on the type of scale they could take in China against cigarettes, you would find people living longer. And there are benefits and disadvantages to that, obviously.
Well, with their population, you'd have to wonder if living longer is going to, what's that going to do to the crowd?
Right. The government has a vested financial interest in making the cigarettes. They may, and this sounds odd, but the government may have a financial interest in not allowing the people to live longer. And I'm not, at this point, even though it's really tempting to slam communist China, I'm not saying that those are their actions. If they are, then the state government of Kentucky has a similar vested interest because they are not taking action against cigarettes. But it is telling this, if this actually went somewhere, there could be some major demographic change in the next few years in the health of Chinese people and in the life expectancy.
But let's get back to the core topic. You are so proud of China, you named a show after them.
That's right. I would name a show after Kentucky if Kentucky banned cigarettes. There it is. I've said it. It's out there on the airways.
How many times have we named a show about Kentucky by the fact that they haven't done anything?
It's time. It
you know,
really
the thing
is.
Tony, think about it. I mean, I've done a lot of travel in the spring, and I've been to places where the bans aren't in effect. It's so noticeable. It's amazing when you live in the cities that have the smoking bans and you go to the one that doesn't. It's so obvious, and it changes your experience. I mean, again, I don't know. I don't understand how more people in Kentucky haven't adopted this, because it's a wonderful experience.
Now, we supposedly live in a democracy, and in a democracy, if you care about this, you can lobby your legislator. This is a great time to do that when the legislature is not in session, to try to set the stage for passage of a statewide smoking ban next session. Well, next session is a short session, but the next long session. I mean, it takes a long time to get these things through. We have to put some pressure on our legislators to do this. This is an excellent time to do that. One of the problems, places that are protected, the populous places, they don't care. They're protected anyway. The rest of the state, unfortunately, has to fare on its own. So if you are not protected, or if you travel places that aren't protected, you have a vested interest in trying to get this passed. I got enough time.
Do you?
Yes.
What if we sit here and go, do you enough?
You would do that. You would spend the next minute and a half going, do you?
Well, I'm wanting to possibly maybe mildly correct you on the whole democracy thing.
All right, fine. We'll stop with this article. Kentucky Kentucky is a democracy. People can change the laws of their state with lobbying.
Aren't we if you go to its most technical form, aren't we technically a republic? Don't we elect people who make the decisions? The democracy is a place where people make the decision.
So you're saying, since we don't allow referenda.
Right.
That we are, in fact, a republic. Our commonwealth is a republic.
Well, I think the U.S. in general is a republic. I think because we actually elect, the democracy is in electing the officials who then make the decision.
Who are democratically elected.
Correct. So I feel compelled to explain the difference between a democracy. Sometimes it explains why we can't get things done, because
why we don't necessarily go
with general population view.
Right. Why something has more than 50% of Kentucky in support of tobacco ban, indoor smoking ban, and yet we cannot get one passed.
Exactly.
Although, you know, the opposition still baffles me.
It's the same concept of you trying to get other things on the show, and I just won't let it happen.
Rick constitutes a majority of Health Matters.
From a volume standpoint, that would be correct.
Well, you did it. You blew my last article. So let's take a break. Rick and I will hash this out democratically, and we'll come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hooray for Communist China show. We are celebrating the fact that Beijing has banned indoor smoking within the city, despite having the demographics that make this a worse financial proposition even than the state of Kentucky. They have done it. We have not. We are looking to Communist China for guidance on how to protect our citizens. That's where we sit in this state. Not that it rankles me. Not that there is sarcasm being
rankles
used.
Rankles you?
It does.
Is that a word, rankle?
The surprising thing is you're sitting there surrounded by a bank of computers, and you did not get rankle looked up before you spouted off here. So Rick has corrected me on democracy and republics. And by the way, all those political scientists in the audience, write in and give me some ammunition as to why Rick is wrong. This will help me the next show. Meanwhile, all of you linguists out there that are obviously disturbed that Rick doesn't know about the word rankle, you can write in to Rick and tell him to grow up. That would be helpful. Our sponsor for the second time, Patient Selection for Lung Cancer Screening, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act insurance packages now pay for lung cancer screening as a screening test. And this is a part of the Affordable Care Act. If it is a screening test, both the insurance plans and Medicare pay for the entire procedure first dollar. You do not have to spend your hard-earned money on a screening test. Now, if they find something, then you got to put some money into it. But even high deductible plans will pay for a screening test first dollar. Here are the people that we are looking for. According to Medicare, if you are 55 to 77 years old, have no symptoms, you have smoked 30 years, one pack a day. They call it 30 pack years. Two packs a day for 15 will get you there too. You have quit, or you have quit smoking less than 15 years ago, then you would be eligible for screening for lung cancer using a CAT scan. In order to do this, you have to talk with your doctor about the benefits and risk of screening, and you have to make the decision to proceed further. You have to get some intervention to help you stop smoking if you are still smoking, and then you get your CAT scan. They are recommended once a year for screening for lung cancer. Now, we mentioned not everybody who smokes is going to get the same benefits. First of all, if you are at high risk for surgery, this is not a good idea. If you take a healthy person older than age 65, having a section of their lung taken out for lung cancer, the risk of dying is about 1%. But if you are ill, the anesthesiologists give you a high risk score. You have shortness of breath when you're walking on level ground. You have a lot of other illnesses. The risk of death can go as high as 17%. So the first thing you've got to figure out is, well, where do you lie on that 1% to 17% risk scale? You certainly don't want to go have a surgery with a 17% risk of killing you. Second thing is, what if there is something else that is killing you? What if you have other chronic diseases and the risk of dying from them is high, so high that even if you had lung cancer, wouldn't matter. People with advanced Alzheimer's disease, advanced heart disease, kidney failure, and so forth are not going to benefit enough from this screening to make it worth their while. And keep in mind, what if you are at low risk for lung cancer? 20% lowest risk people in the research trials of lung cancer screening accounted for 1% of the prevented deaths. Again, you screened 20% of these people for only 1% of the prevented deaths. Third fractional portion, we'll talk about who is high risk and who we recommend to get screening, but that's our sponsor, Patient Selection for Lung Cancer Screening.
So Tony, before you get started, it's entirely possible I may have to change my middle name. I may have to change my middle name to Rankle.
You like it, huh?
To cause persistent irritation or resentment. To cause someone to feel irritated or resentful.
How about if we combine Rick and Rankle and we just call you Wrinkle?
To become sore or inflamed or to fester.
We could call you Fester.
To feel or express irritation or resentment about something.
Such as the fact that Kentucky will not pass an indoor smoking ban, despite the fact that we have the nation's highest rate of lung cancer, the nation's highest rate of smokers, the highest rate of cancer-related deaths. We simply can't do it, and communist China can.
Sounds
how
like
bad
both
can
wrangled.
That be? I am definitely rankled. You start me up, and then you shut me down. Back to...
To what? You weren't
doing
anything.
Back to our second fractional portion. That's right. Give me a break here, Rick. We need to get started doing something worthwhile other than getting... We're going to rankle our audience, as a matter of fact. That'd be the problem. There is a service. I use a lot of news lines, RSS feeds, and other ways of getting my medical information. Interestingly enough, Rick, I don't read that many journals cover to cover anymore. I usually know what's in the journal before it even comes out because there are all these press releases now that tell you the contents of the journal. One of these is something called Medscape. Many people know their patient portal, the WebMD portal, but Medscape is for physicians, and Medscape has now been online 20 years.
Wow. And I mean, it's funny because, you know, granted, it's what, to 2015? Yeah, I mean, obviously the internet was really starting to make a public appearance, starting in 90. So interesting, that would have been the Medscape was on the internet very, very early in the internet's, kind of lifespan.
And they've been very successful. Medscape will send to my inbox a listing of headlines. I click on the headline. The story comes up. I can find they have the reference article if I need to go look for details and so forth. It's a remarkable service. I enjoy using this service. They ask experts to describe the top 20 changes that occurred in medical care over their past 20 years. I sort of thinned these down, and I found 15. We'll get to as many as we can, but these are some of the biggest changes in healthcare over the last 20 years. And again, I am in agreement with some of these experts on these things. One of them was in cardiology. They asked their cardiologist, what's the biggest thing that's happened? He said these statins, these cholesterol-lowering drugs, for what they call secondary prevention, after you've had a heart attack, after you've had heart surgery, after you've had bypass or stents placed, going on statins has made a major difference. A phenomenal impact is the words they use.
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal on your risk of having a second problem. Declining rates in coronary intervention, such as bypass surgery. I mean, bypass surgery is not a very common surgery anymore. We have put some cardiac bypass surgeons practically out of business because the reoperates are much slower than they were before.
Isn't that a good thing?
Yes.
I mean, that's something to be kind of celebrated.
Well, a lot of us know a person who had a heart attack and then just basically went back to doing everything they were doing before. And this was before the heart attack was basically the pre-death notice that your heart was no longer capable of supporting life, but that is gone. People recover, have a full life after heart attacks, after bypass surgery, and so forth. And one of the things that's happened is because of these statins. The other thing that was interesting is, in order to understand what they did, we started what we call multi-center trials. It took so many people to understand the benefits, to outline these benefits, they would have to recruit from several universities tied together. And this is now the standard for new drugs. We can recruit hundreds or thousands of patients fairly rapidly and follow them extensively using multiple centers collaborating together. And so these trials have gotten much bigger, and the statins were a real driver of that. Second one, rheumatology. This is one I like. Targeted biopharmaceuticals. This is the main ones are something called tumor necrosis factor inhibitors, or TNF inhibitors. Now, this is something that you're thinking, okay, this is just real esoteric. I've never heard of this. Let me read the names of these drugs. Humira for rheumatoid arthritis. Epigen, which helps you get your energy back and recover your blood cell function faster after cancer chemotherapy. Enbrel for rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis. You may remember we've got a professional golf for actually advertising now for Enbrel. Remicade for colon problems, colon inflammatory bowel disease, as well as other types of arthritis. And then there is one called Herceptin for breast cancer. It's a monoclonal antibody rather than a TNF antagonist. But these drugs have really changed the way we treat inflammatory arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, psoriasis, and inflammatory bowel disease. Tumor necrosis factor turned out to be a real driver of inflammation. And if we can get something to block that inflammation, we can have a major effect on the course and the progression of some of these arthritic conditions. And your professional golfer can get back to playing golf, or in the commercial, he plays soccer with his kids, which I think is a laugh because I don't think golf guys play much soccer.
No.
Yeah. Just pointing that out. Next up, from the infectious disease people, heart. Highly active antiretroviral therapy for HIV/AIDS. This is one in my lifetime, in my career time, HIV/AIDS went from a death sentence to a chronic disease.
Wow.
More HIV/AIDS patients die of heart conditions now than die of their viral illness.
But now we put tons of money, tons of interest, tons of energy into HIV/AIDS.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you know, right about what, that late 90s time frame, they really ramped up the research. They ramped up everything about it. And this is what we do when we put our mind to solving problems. You know, I think when we decide as a society, this is the way we need to go, it's pretty amazing what we can do.
Yeah. And this is an example, a killer disease that is now a chronic illness. People live in 20 years with HIV/AIDS because we have developed this antiretroviral therapy. And the fact that we learned how to do this now has spilled over to the next one. This is from gastroenterology. Not spend a lot of time on this because you've heard us talk time and time again about it. Treatment of hepatitis C, a chronic hepatitis condition, $1,000 a pill. But these pills probably are going to change the course of hepatitis, possibly to cure, possibly to get rid of this. Anyway, the biggest advance, according to Paul Martin at the University of Miami and David Johnson at Eastern Virginia Medical School, this is one of the biggest things to happen in gastroenterology in the past 20 years. Pulmonary medicine, the move to smoke-free. Ironic, isn't it? That was their greatest achievement in the past 20 years. The recognition of tobacco use as a health hazard, as cited by the CDC, as one of the great public health advances of the 20th century, and the adoption of smoke-free laws. Exposure to secondhand smoke has declined by half, from 52% of the population in 1999 down to 25% in 2012. Most of those people, I am editorializing, live in Kentucky.
Well, they certainly don't live in China.
Nope. Well, maybe not. They may not.
No, but it goes back to what we were talking about before. I mean, you know, again, the learning curve and the time it's going to take for China to get on par with us in this particular area is going to happen considerably faster than what it did for us. And so the thing is once a country like, you know, China goes, what's next? India? You know, at that point, you get this wave of things happening. And I mean, Kentucky could very well find itself behind many, many other countries.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to happen. It's just how many people have to die before something is done. That's the embarrassing thing.
Yeah. It does show you the power of the what do you call it, the dependency of nicotine.
Yep.
It's such a dependent drug.
And inactivity in the face of this, the urgent drives that we have, it's just amazing. But moving on, we've already talked enough about that, I suppose, for now. In public health, the advancement of palliative care. Now, that's something that you wouldn't think would be one of the big stories of the past 20 years. I'm going to read this.
Well, but now, Tony, how many palliative, I mean, 25, 30 years ago, you didn't even know that was a position. You know, now you've actually got physicians that's their role.
That's what they do. And I'll read what they say. With modern technology, healthcare has come a long way in helping people live longer. But with this comes a recognition that end-of-life matters deserve appropriate attention and discussion from clinicians. It's less about doing more treatments and more about doing less harm and ensuring our patients enjoy the quality of life they desire when time becomes limited. That is, every one of us, every single one of us, every day makes decisions based on a limited life expectancy. What do you want to do with your life? What do you want to do with the time that you've got left? Some of those decisions are career decisions, marital decisions, decisions to have children, decisions to move, to stay, those type of things. They're all made in a real slow and progressive way for most of us. This accelerates when we have chronic diseases. But the problem is many of us still just do what we're told, check ourselves into the intensive care unit. Even in the final weeks, the final days of our life, we wind up spending them in an ICU. And I think if we are more deliberate about this and start thinking of how we want to live rather than just blindly following advice, we will in fact live better. And in some cases, in the case of some types of cancers, we will live actually longer if we act out our desire to live a comfortable and a joyous life rather than receiving all the chemotherapy that the chemotherapy doctor says we should receive. So this is something that it's a decision that has to be made in conjunction with a doctor who understands your prognosis and also understands the benefits and the risk of treatments so that we're not dying as an experiment in how many rounds of chemo you can get or how many tubes can be placed. We rather are dying in a way that we feel is the best way for us to die. So palliative care, one of the big ones. This one will also surprise you, Rick.
Okay.
And I put this in because I really believe in this one. Orthopedics, the big advance in orthopedics, according to Ira Kirschenbaum, who's the chairman of orthopedics at Bronx Lebanon Hospital in New York, he says probably the greatest advance in orthopedics in the past two decades has been the way we look at success or failure of treatment interventions. It's called patient-reported outcome measures. Now, you've seen this over and over again. This has changed science. It used to be a successful surgery was one where everything was hooked up properly, and when you finished the surgery, the patient wasn't bleeding. In other words, if you moved, cut out the bad part, attached the good parts together, stitched it up, and didn't get an infection, you had a successful surgery. In orthopedics now, they're asking, can this patient walk better than they did before? Does this knee replacement improve their activity? Do they have a better life afterwards? And that is a whole different question, and what you really want to know, rather than, was the wound closed properly? Were there any germs or tools left inside the operational field?
Well, I think also, Tony, I think some of those things, those quantitative measurements, they're ways to, I mean, right now we still look at those, right? We still want to know whether they got a post-op infection. We still want to know, you know, was everything technically successful on the actual surgery? I think the difference here is we've added a layer to this that gives outcome, you know, as part of the metrics or analytics that we use to drive how we're changing and doing things. And I think it's pretty cool. I mean, and I think it's funny, we've seen the same thing in computers over the years as to where you take one thing with a computer, and when you get the new computer or the new thing, you don't throw out the old, you build on top of it. And so I think that's what's occurring here, is I think we're taking the standard of care and we're building.
Success is defined as whether or not the patient's satisfied rather than whether or not the thing works the way
stop
the way
but,
you
but I think
plan.
Some of those other things have to happen for B. So what happens is those things can happen and you still have a bad outcome.
Right.
So now, but if those things happen, you'll never have a good outcome.
Right. Right.
So again, we're building on.
I got you. A couple of things quickly, because I want to get to one other that I think is kind of important.
You're
diabetes care.
You're not going to be able to.
Medications and monitoring. Lots of diabetes drugs out there. Some of them decent, some of them not. And better monitoring. This is John Buse, professor of medicine at University of North Carolina. 20 years ago, every day there were patients in my lobby with amputations, seeing eye dogs, or white canes. Today, it is so rare, I'm convinced we're only beginning to understand what the natural history of diabetes will be.
Think about it now, when you can start wearing these biometric packs on your wrist, and we figure out a way to do this without sticking somebody with a needle. needle, just think where we're going to go in the next phase.
Right. Radiology said the PET scan, plastic surgery said Botox, emergency medicine said ultrasound. Doctors are using ultrasound, and they believe it will eventually replace their stethoscope as a way to do patient exams. Here's the one I wanted to spend that last minute of this section on. Vaccines as cancer prevention. We're talking about HPV, human papillomavirus vaccine, the most significant development in medicine, one of the most in the past 2 decades, according to Kathy Miller, who's director of breast cancer program at Indiana University of Medicine. These vaccines, first approved in 2006, may prevent up to 90% of cervical cancers. Our job is to try to get these vaccines out. They are very safe. They are very effective. It is tough to there are some moral concerns that they will make our children in some way more promiscuous. Those have not been shown to happen by science, but this is an important thing. The other thing, let's just continue that further. The fact that we know now that HPV does cause cervical cancer is going to change the way we screen, with probably will eventually replace pap smears as a way of screening for cervical cancer. So that was a huge advance in the last 20 years. We're going to make a small advance to our third and final fractional portion, but first we'll take a break. Why don't you do so as well? You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hooray for Communist China show. We are saluting our friends in Beijing who did what we could not do in the Republic of Kentucky.
You can say Commonwealth. That's
Thank
okay.
Thank you. The Commonwealth of Kentucky, they passed an indoor smoking ban, despite the fact that they have more smokers, despite the fact that cigarettes are still much more intertwined into their culture, despite the fact that their government actually produces cigarettes, they were able to pass a smoking ban when we were not. Now, enforcement is still an issue. This smoking ban may experience difficulties in enforcement. I would love to have that problem here in Kentucky. Let's get one passed and see what we can do. Maybe we can regain our status as being slightly more concerned about our citizens than communist China. Our sponsor for the final time, lung cancer screening, reminding you Medicare and the Affordable Care Act insurances will pay completely, first dollar, last dollar, no deductible, no copays for lung cancer screening if you meet these criteria. You are 55 to 77 years old. You have been smoking 30 pack years. That's a pack a day for 30 years, 2 packs a day for 15 years, half a pack a day for 60 years. You do the math. Any way you can get to 30 pack years, you will be eligible. If you quit, you should have quit less than 15 years ago, because after 15 years, your risk of lung cancer goes down to the point where it doesn't really pay to screen. You should discuss the risk and benefits with your doctor, and this is not just simply them handing you a piece of paper that has the risk and benefits. You've got to go over these things and realize just exactly what the possibilities are, because these screens oftentimes will pick out something that may or may not be a cancer. You're going to have some follow-up. You have to make that decision as to whether or not you want to go through screening, and then finally, you have to have a documented attempt to stop smoking or some type of intervention for tobacco cessation in order to get the money from Medicare for your free lung cancer screening. We talked about lower risk people. The 20% bottom risk people had only 1% of the prevented deaths of screening. That's not a good set of odds in your favor. What we mean is you'll be spending way too much money. We'll be doing way too many CAT scans on these lower risk people. But what about the higher risk people? Here's an example. You got a 55-year-old guy smokes a pack a day for 30 years. He quit 10 years ago. He has about a 0.5% risk of dying from lung cancer in the next 6 years. So if you quit 10 years ago and you were only one pack a day for 30 years, then your risk of dying is very small. You would have to screen 1,000 people to avoid one death. Take a 70-year-old smoking two packs a day for 50 years and still smoking, they have a 5% risk of dying from lung cancer in the next 6 years. 1 in 20 risk of dying. So if you screened 100 people and you could lower your death rate by 20%, you're going to save a life every 100 people you screen. That's the point where it really makes a difference. Who are the high-risk people? Again, people who are older, people who, interestingly enough, people who have a low body mass index. If you smoke and your lungs are bad enough that you are thin because you are chronically ill, that actually makes your risk worse. So people who are overweight actually have a lower risk of lung cancer than people who are underweight. Pack years of smoking, the more you smoke, the longer you smoke, the higher the risk. Very simple. If you have emphysema, that means the smoking damaged your lung, and that damage may be what sets off the cancer as your lung tries to repair itself. You've got a 56% higher risk of lung cancer if you have emphysema. And then finally, if you have a first-degree relative, your father, mother, brother, sister had lung cancer, that's a 27% higher risk. So when we see an older heavy smoker, still smoking, a thin person who has a little bit of emphysema and had a family member die of lung cancer, those are the ones we particularly want to screen. Those are, in fact, the highest risk people who could benefit from lung cancer screening. That's our sponsor, Patient Selection for Lung Cancer Screening. Now, Rick, it's been all joy here. Beijing passed a smoking ban. There have been advances in HPV, advances in the way we determine surgical successes, PET scans, Botox, wonderful things, hepatitis C, and HIV treatments.
What about you being rankled?
Well, for some people, that's a wonderful thing. Some people live to rankle me, not naming names, not pointing fingers, just looking across
the studio. Don't point.
Just looking across the studio. But it's not all peaches and cream. It's not all whatever.
Have you ever actually eaten peaches and cream?
Yeah, oddly enough.
I've heard it talked about all my life. Nobody's ever served it to me.
You know, and it was
We usually have peach cobbler.
Here's the thing. I mean, you think of it's not all peaches and cream. You think, well, there's something bad here. To be honest with you, peaches and cream, certainly not favorite. So I don't know why I use that. How about it's not all Oreos and milk here? Now we're talking, huh?
Hang on a second.
We're going to let this
pause the show,
waft over the airways and let you think about the fact that it's not all Oreos and milk here in our studio. As a matter of fact, I do want to talk to you quite seriously about one thing. This is a little editorial that Gary Franklin, he's from the University of Washington in Seattle. He was the one that reported the first U.S. deaths due to the opioid prescription, the narcotic prescription epidemic, and he is writing an editorial. I'm just going to read some of the things that he said. In the early 1990s, we had the worst man-made epidemic in medical history with over 140,000 deaths from unintentional overdose of narcotics, many more hundreds of thousands of overdose hospital admissions, and millions of people addicted or dependent on these narcotics. And as we look back on this, and hopefully this is now a historical oddity and not something we will never repeat again, we chronicled it here in Kentucky. We were, in fact, ground zero. We were the epicenter. We were where this started here in West Virginia. We paid a heavy price with this. In some counties, at the height of this, they were losing 40 people a year from a rural county due to overdose deaths.
Wow.
Knocked the life expectancy of the whole county down. These were horrendous times. And here's what Franklin says. He says, as narcotics caught on in the 1990s, clinicians were taught that there was really no dosage ceiling. That is, the more, if people got tolerant to their effects, you simply increase the dose and nothing would go wrong. You would get a better response. And there weren't any real dose-dependent side effects. There were lobbying efforts, and there were several drug companies involved in this. 20 state laws were actually amended to include language saying that there would be no disciplinary action taken against a practitioner based solely on the quantity or frequency of your opioids prescribed. That is, you could prescribe huge amounts of narcotics, and they were not going to investigate you just because you prescribed those narcotics. I remember we had pain as a vital sign. That is, we were charting every day whether or not you actually had a painful condition. We would check your blood pressure and your pulse, and we would ask you, are you in pain, and what are your pain levels? We were, at that point, we had decided that narcotics were a suitable treatment for chronic non-cancer pain. Then we found out that our arthritis medicines, we call those non-steroidals, had heart side effects. And so the American Heart Association, the American Geriatric Society, both recommended narcotics as a treatment for chronic painful conditions. In 2015, a review of randomized trials by the NIH concluded there are no data to determine the efficacy of long-term narcotic treatment for chronic pain. That is, we don't know if long-term narcotic treatment pays off. Meanwhile, 140,000 people dying, 1,000 people a year or so in the state of Kentucky, many of them from rural Kentucky, many of them from eastern Kentucky, are dying, and we don't know if these drugs work or not. There's not sufficient data to tell. The higher doses, the risk for overdose increases. Six states have implemented a dosing threshold for narcotics, that is, that there are levels that you should not exceed, and the narcotic deaths have started dropping. But I wanted to remind our viewers, it was a combination of marketing OxyContin. I saw this happening. It rankled me, if you want to call it that, Rick. Because
again?
Yes, because you could see a company profiting off of getting rural people hooked on this drug. I will tell you, I was not as anti-narcotic then as I am now, and I probably should have been. I definitely should have been. It's frustrating to me that I sort of let that slide. I should not have let that slide. That's pretty clear. This was from the Medical Association Internal Medicine Journal. There were two researchers at Harvard, a guy named Mark LaRochelle, Pilgrim Health Care Institute, and he's Department of Population Medicine at Harvard, and his associates, I guess it's LaRochelle is the main guy, they looked at this epidemic we have. And I'll just read the introduction to their story. Overdose deaths attributable to narcotics quadrupled between 1999 and 2010, with rapidly expanding sales of narcotics. There were two steps taken by the drug companies themselves. One, the OxyContin, which was behind a lot of this, they changed the formulation so that you couldn't crush it and you couldn't inject it. And then we took propoxyphene. They call that Darvon or Darvocet,
okay,
a very popular drug in eastern Kentucky. That was removed from the market because it had a higher abuse potential than other narcotics. So they looked at an insurance database covering 31 million patients in all 50 states to look and see in their mind, and according to them, what happened after those two medication changes. OxyContin goes to non-crushable, non-injectable form, and Darvocet goes off the market. They said there were 12,000 overdoses between 2003 and 2012 in this particular database, and when these drugs were taken off the market, there was a sudden, this is their words, sudden, substantial, and sustained decrease in the prescription narcotics dispensing and a decline in fatal overdoses. They dropped by 19% in the year 2011 and by 20% further in 2012, overall 39% drop in those 2 years in narcotics overdoses. They said there would be then, according to, if you extrapolate that to all residents of the U.S., there would be 5,000 and change fewer prescription overdoses every year. The AMA Journal people were very excited. The first study to demonstrate that a decrease in narcotic supply is associated with a decrease in prescriptions and overdoses. And Rick, you know, this radio show in 2003, we were in the middle of this narcotic overdose epidemic.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, all the states around us did not have systems like Casper, and it was making it very difficult. There was tons and tons of drug problems.
Right. Now, my problem is these guys looked at this particular time, 2010 is when some of these changes were made. They look at this time and they said, wow, look at what the drug companies were able to do by changing their formulation, which rankles me, Rick.
Yeah.
I am re-rankled by this. Just a reminder, Kentucky, our pill mill bill took effect in 2012.
Wasn't it like House Bill 1 the year it was passed? It was the number one priority.
Right. House Bill 1 took effect and changed the state of narcotic prescriptions within the Republic of Kentucky. The other thing that happened, this was in 2010, between 2010 and 2011, the feds finally shut down the pill mills in Florida. And so I just to make sure I have my times right here on this, I went to the Tampa Tribune, and they had a little summary back in August of 2014. In 2010, manufacturers shipped more than 650 million oxycodone pills to Florida. That number dropped to under $527 million in 2011 and has continued to drop every year. In 2010, they had 93, the state of Florida had 93 of the top 100 oxycodone dispensing doctors in the United States. 93 out of 100 lived in one state. In 2010, Florida had 856 pain clinics.
856 pain clinics.
And at that time, and Rick, you will remember this, again, we had flights out of Huntington, West Virginia, direct flights out of Lexington, crowded with people headed to Florida to pick up their narcotics pills. They would go to pain clinics in Florida, and there were direct flights down there specifically to cater to this. These narcotics were spewing all over the South.
So, Tony, if my math is right, and it usually is, we have 67 counties in Florida. 856. That is like, well, forget it. I'm not going to do the math. That's a lot of pain clinics to go in 67 counties.
It's basically,
I mean, it's more than 10 per county.
It's door-to-door-to-door pain clinics.
I mean, now, granted, I get it. Miami's a big place, but you probably got a few places that aren't very heavily populated in the middle of the Everglades.
Florida was baffled. Florida was stymied.
Alligators.
Florida
there.
Was...
That's why they need pain clinics.
Florida was buffaloed. And so the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, actually did Operation Pill Mill Nation. Not Operation Pill Mill Florida, not Operation Pill Mill Tampa, but Operation Pill Mill Nation to shut down these nationally active pill mills. They dropped again from 650 million oxycodones a year to 313 million in 2013. Their pain clinics dropped from 856 to 367. And they mentioned people came from all over the place, from Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, and Tennessee, direct flights into Florida. One clinic alone in between January and July of 2010, in a six-month period, 2,000 patients from 23 states made 4,700 visits. They paid the clinic more than $850,000 in fees 6 months. So this clinic is making $1.5 million in fees just treating pain patients from out of state. They were given prescriptions for more than 1 million oxycodone pills in 6 months. Another clinic had a staging area because they didn't have enough room in their parking lot for all the patients that were coming in to get their pills. So in conjunction with this amazing reformulation that these Harvard researchers are talking about, Kentucky shut down our pill mills, the Fed shut down the Florida pill mills, there was a sea change nationally. And you may have someone that you love. You may have someone that you know who has responded to narcotics and you feel that narcotics are a good thing. I see hundreds of thousands of people dying nationally. I see tens of thousands of people dying, 1,000 people a year in the state of Kentucky. I see counties decimated by overdoses. These drugs, narcotics, are not worth the price we have paid for them. Again, one of the greatest man-made epidemics in modern medicine has been this narcotic thing, and we are starting to see the end of it. So I'm ashamed, I am rankled, and at the same time, You're right. Can you get us off the air?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Spencer Johnson and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote the Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook just to a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters is a prescription radio show used to reduce the signs and symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis, polyarticular juvenile idiopathic arthritis in children 2 years of age and older, psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, Crohn's disease, moderate to severe Crohn's disease when other treatments have not worked well enough.
You should discuss the potential benefits and risks of Health Matters with your doctor. Health Matters is a TNF blocker radio show that can lower your ability of your immune system to fight infections. You should not start listening to Health Matters if you have any kind of infection unless your doctor says it's okay.
Serious infections have happened to people listening to Health Matters, including tuberculosis, infections caused by viruses, fungi, or bacteria that have spread throughout the body. Some people have died from these infections.
Your doctor should test you for TB before starting Health Matters and check you closely for signs and symptoms of TB during treatment with Health Matters. If your doctor feels you're at risk, you may be treated with medicine for TB.
There have been cases of unusual cancers in children, teenagers, and young adults using TNF blocker radio shows such as Health Matters. Some people have developed a rare type of cancer called hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma. lymphoma. This type of cancer often results in death.
Health Matters may increase your chance of getting two types of skin cancer. These types are generally not life-threatening if treated. Tell your doctor if you have a bump or open sore that doesn't heal.
Tell your doctor if you have a bump. That's right. But whatever
bump.
You do...
Boom.
That's right. Do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week as we discuss how to turn your room into a rheumatoid on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.